Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Back in 1967, a very strange thing happened in a high school history classroom in California. Something amazing. Something that turned the then-emerging me generation on its head and showed us how we could have a real youth revolution, a white youth revolution, instead of the synthetic destruction of youth revolution we got instead. Something that was intended to be a lesson against hate, but which quickly turned into a demonstration of something quite different indeed. To tell you about this amazing event, first I'm going to turn the microphone over to longtime public school teacher and National Vanguard writer Dr. Jeff Hilton to tell us the very compelling story of the third wave. Then I'll return and reveal to you some of the very surprising facts that have come to light since Mr. Hilton recorded his talk. Dr. Hilton begins by telling us that students naturally seek out real leadership, inspiring ideals, true discipline, and rational order, though that is something that they all too seldom receive from our school system today. Dr. Hilton. You're listening to American Dissident Voices.
I've come to realize that these kids are really searching for something. You know, they're searching for order. This was brought out very, very graphically, you know, the potential for this group. In Cubberly High School, I'm going to be talking about the third wave, if some of you have heard about it. There was a TV program about it, a liberal TV program that said, oh, no, this can't happen in a liberal high school, but it did. Cubberly High School in Palo Alto, California. Now, remember, this was right in the middle of the do-your-own-thing, the Haight-Ashbury movement, you know, Janis Joplin, that kind of stuff, Big Brother and the Holding Company, that crazy Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters were running around with a yellow bus, you know, sipping LSD and all that sort of thing, all that groovy stuff, the Doors and things. But a man by the name of Ron Jones was a liberal teacher out there in Palo Alto, and they didn't believe in bells, and they didn't believe in textbooks and things, but they were talking about the Holocaust nonetheless. And this was on a Friday afternoon, and Mr. Jones, the teacher, was asked, well, listen, Mr. Jones, if they really killed 6 million Jews, why was it that the German people just stood around and did nothing? You know, I mean, they could have seen the trains, they could have seen the smoke, they could have seen the bones, you know, I mean, they should have seen something. Why didn't they, you know, why didn't they try to stop him? And Jones didn't know, you know, being a good liberal that's, you know, this lobotomized front part of his brain just, you know, kind of shut off when he heard that. But he didn't realize, you know, he didn't have an answer for it. So what he said, what he decided to do after he went home that day was to show these kids how easy it is to become a totalitarian cog in a machine, supposedly. You know, this is his outlook. So Monday morning, what he did was he came into the school, his classroom. Now, these are 10th graders. These kids are about 14, probably. All white, all fluent, you know, all freaky. You know, the long hair, the bells, and whatever they had on them. Okay. He started off, and he said, now, kids, today what I'm going to do for the first time is I'm going to lecture. And they go, oh, lecture, man, like, that's not cool, you know. He said, oh, well, I'm just going to talk to you about the beauty of discipline. And so Mr. Jones started off talking about discipline, and he said, now look, athletes have to work hard, don't they, in order to run a 9-second 100. How about a dedicated scientist? You know, the scientist has to work really, really hard to develop that new idea. A ballet dancer to perfect her movements or his movements. Right? Listen, I think what we ought to do, as I talk about the strength through discipline, is sit properly, okay? How about everybody, you know, in this class, you know, they're slouched over like that, you know, that kind of stuff. He said, why don't you just sit up straight? Now, doesn't that feel better? He said, now put your hands out in front of the desk. Now, doesn't that, isn't that more comfortable? Put your feet flat on the floor instead of trying to kick your neighbor, right? You know, doesn't that feel better? Can't you think better? Aren't you better reposed that way? And he said, strength through discipline is going to take self-training through control into the power of the will. He said, that's the ultimate triumph that we can have, is power through the will. He said, exercise, we're going to have to try and exercise and practice seating. He had everybody get up on and line up on the wall and then quickly go back to your seat, the same position. And everybody kind of liked it. I quote him. He said, it was strange how quickly the students took to the uniform code of behavior. I began to wonder just how far they could be pushed. Was this display of obedience a momentary game, or were we playing on something else, with something else? Was the desire for discipline and uniformity a natural need? I'll tell Mr. Jones right now it is. You know, as a teacher, I can see it. A social instinct we hide within our franchise restaurants and TV programming. So the next day, on Tuesday, what he did was he came in and he said, you know, we can not only gain strength through discipline from ourselves, but we can gain strength through discipline through our community. And he talked about community as a bond between individuals who work and struggle together. It's raising a barn with your neighbors. It's feeling that you're a part of something beyond yourself, a movement, a team. And you know, it's funny, Mr. Jones said, but learning became crisp and attentive. Soon everyone in the class began popping up with answers to questions. The involvement level increased from a few who had always contributed to the entire class took a part in this. He decided on Tuesday to create a class salute. And the salute was this. It was a cupped hand. Now, to us in the Midwest, that doesn't mean anything. It's like, you know, catching a fly ball or something. But out on the West Coast, it has a meaning of waves coming into a beach. And Jones talked a little bit, you know, these kids were surfer kids. You know, they hung around at Redondo Beach and places like that and Muscle Beach and Topanga Canyon and places like that in Los Angeles. And he said, the third wave is always the hardest wave to hit the beach, and that's the one that the surfers always like to catch, the third wave. He said, no, we'll be the third wave. We'll be the strongest wave to hit this beach. Right? And so waves travel in chains. They go together. We'll be the third. We'll be the strongest waves. You know, the colored know this hand jive stuff, you know, with like that. It breeds compatibility. It gives them some sort of a community to go down the street slapping palms and doing whatever they do, you know. Well, this is the third wave, like that. So all these kids from this world history class would walk down in the halls giving the third wave salute to their other class members. Now, they didn't give the third wave salute to everybody in the school, just their own class, right? Wednesday, Jones issued identification cards with a third wave on it, right? He lectured on the meaning of action. And he said, I explained how discipline and community were meaningless without action. I discussed the beauty of taking full responsibility for one's actions, of believing so thoroughly in yourself and your community or family or your race, but he didn't say that, that you'll do anything to preserve, protect, or extend that being. I stressed how hard work and alliance with others would allow accelerated learning and accomplishment, and it did in the classroom. Performance and academic skills were significantly improved. They were learning more, and they liked it, and they took part in it. Thursday night or Wednesday night, the rabbi called when he got home. He said, Mr. Jones, what are you doing to my kids? I've had many conversations with parents. They don't like this. What is this third wave thing that looks like a Nazi salute? And Jones said, now listen, Finkelbaum. I'm just messing with their minds. I'm gonna stomp on them. All I'm doing is just showing them how it's easy to become a fascist. Oh, very good, Mr. Jones. It's a very good example of this Nazi fascism. You know, thank you very much. Hung up. And he had the rabbi in his pocket, you know. But Jones didn't know what to do with this on Wednesday. He didn't understand that he had gotten the groundswell, he had touched the groundswell, a nerve in the whites. Wednesday he went in and explained that, again, you have to have discipline through community. He issued the ID cards on Tuesday. He said performance and academic skill areas were significant on Wednesday. And it started to snowball on him. That evening, like I said, the rabbi called. And what happened was that the rabbi was now in there. Thursday he talked about pride. He said pride is more than banners or salutes. Pride is something no one can take from you. He said, pride's knowing you're the best, and it can't be destroyed. and I'll quote this, in slow melodic tones I explained that what was behind the third wave wasn't an experiment or classroom activity. It was far more important than that. The third wave was a nationwide program. Now he's telling this to the students. To find students who are willing to fight for political change in this country. That's right. This activity we've been doing hasn't been practiced for the real thing. It is the real thing. Across the country, teachers like myself have been recruiting and training youth capable of showing pride and action. We can change the destiny of this nation. Now, he told these kids this. We can bring in a new sense of order, community, pride, and action, a new purpose. Everything rests with you and your willingness to take a stand. And he told that to those kids, whereas a week before he would have been booted out of class, you know, for that. On Friday, he said, what's going to happen is we're going to go to the auditorium and we'll meet the national leader. The national leader will be on television and we will see him on television and he will tell us exactly what to do. On Friday, there wasn't a seat left in the auditorium. Now, what happened was that Jones made a very big issue out of taking the TV set. It was a portable TV set, plugging it into the auditorium and letting it sit there. What happened was that he turned it between channels and it was fuzzy. And he just left it there and closed the kids up in the auditorium. After about 5 minutes, a girl shrieked out, "There's no leader," and started to cry. And the entire audience started to cry and yell, and they broke up the TV set, almost, you know, they in the vernacular, trashed the place, all right? And what Jones did, I think, personally, is despicable. I mean, he played with the most basic thoughts and emotions of these 14- and 15-year-old kids. But we can take heart at what Jones did, because, believe me, that potential is within most of the white kids, especially coming out of the busing situation. That's the third wave.
American Dissident Voices. In 1972, that is, 5 years after the experiment, Jones published one version of these events in an article in the Whole Earth Catalog, which has been reprinted several times. The story's also been retold, even by Jones himself, in slightly different versions and in different venues. Recent research indicates that the event did indeed happen, though Jones apparently embellished it a bit to make for a better story. The entire movement supposedly blossomed in just 5 days, which seems a bit far-fetched. And some of the embellishments that Jones and colleagues have added in recent years, including secret police, trials, and enforcer gangs, make the 5-day time frame even less likely. Nevertheless, the testimony of students indicate the experiment did take place, and most significantly to us, did result in an astonishing and positive response from the white students, organized, disciplined, and inspired to work for the good of their community. Dr. Hilton, in his talk, was relying for most of his information on one of Jones's own versions of events. The third wave story has even been made into a young adult novel and film. It's Jones's main claim to fame, and I think its success is only partly due to the compelling story. Part also has to be due to the anti-hate aspect, which the media and the Jewish supremacists find very useful indeed. Jones, in fact, after being fired from the high school and working for years as a Special Olympics sports coach and PE director, has been in the process of making something of a career out of his decades-old experiment. A recent video blurb blubbers, quote, "Churches, temples, and Jewish organizations nationwide have used this video to stimulate discussions on past religious persecutions and reconcile and heal present displays of racism," close quote. In the process of self-promotion, Jones has recently told us he's half Jewish, quote, "the child of an interfaith marriage," close quote. His official biography states, quote, "Jones, whose mother was Jewish, was not raised a Jew. His parents celebrated Christmas, but we went to synagogue whenever the relatives came to town or for weddings and bar mitzvahs, he said. He credits his Jewish grandmother with influencing his interest in storytelling. What I remember most about Jewish life is the dinner table and listening to her stories, close quote. Philosopher Lyle Burkhead gives one possible explanation for Jones's project, the inculcation of guilt in whites and the utilization of pre-existing guilt in that task. He explains, quote, most people have an uneasy feeling that they are guilty about something, but they aren't sure what it is. It's there, but they don't want to bring it into full consciousness and identify it. Mr. Jones plays on that hidden guilt. That's what gives the story its energy. He reframes our vague feeling of guilt and tells us we are secretly harboring hostile thoughts about the Jews and we are in denial about it. There is no way to challenge this except to acknowledge the feelings we really do feel guilty about, which would involve bringing things into consciousness that we don't want to think about. So, we accept his accusation and pass it on to our children. Well done, Mr. Jones. Freud would be proud, not to mention your grandmother. Close quote. Burkhead, who has come to respect the Holocaust revisionists, adds, quote, there are reasons for questioning whether the most notorious part of the Holocaust happened, i.e. the gas chambers. Nevertheless, everyone, including the revisionists, acknowledges the obvious fact that the Holocaust, in a general sense, did happen. Jews were rounded up and shipped off to concentration camps where many of them died. This is not in dispute. What I do want to dispute is the alleged causal link. If we lead disciplined, purposeful lives, then we are going to end up killing Jews. If we find strength in discipline, strength in community, and strength in action, then we are going to end up killing Jews. If we share fully in life, as in the wave, then we will end up killing Jews. That's what we are supposed to believe. It's not true. In fact, it's so obviously absurd that I wonder how anyone could believe it. I also wonder why some people want us to believe it. Why is this so important to them? That's the real puzzle. Wait a minute. Is it possible that I'm missing something here? Is it conceivable that they could be right after all? If we try to establish the kingdom of God in our minds and in our communities, then we will inevitably have to fight the Jews? Close quote. It looks to me like Burkhead and Stephen Romer should get together, if they haven't already. When Ron Jones, the perennial storyteller and admitted hoaxer, tells us that he's part Jewish, something he never mentioned when the Wave story originally came out, in almost the same breath as he admits he's been hired by and squired by all over the world several leading Jewish supremacist groups, I have to admit I am skeptical. But it may be true. In the end, that doesn't matter, because the real lesson of the third wave isn't to be found in any evils of fascism homily. The real lesson is that Jones tapped into something that white people need, especially white students in their formative teen years, a sense of community, of unity, of excellence, of peoplehood. Jones gave those children what Pepsi and Giorgio Armani and GQ and TV can never give them. Even if Jones is a charlatan, even if he's a one-trick pony working the crumb end of the Jewish supremacist theater circuit, it doesn't matter. He stumbled on something important despite himself. Something that we as a people used to know, but have forgotten in these days of consumerism and racial death. It's our job, as men and women inspired with a vision of a future for white people, to give back to our people, especially our young people, the feeling of purpose and of being part of something great, something eternal, that those kids in Jones's class had for such a short time before he ground their dreams into dirt. We need to do it much better. And we can. We need to do it for real. And we can. And we need to do it on a much larger scale. And we can. Let us begin today.
Dissident Voices.